Good afternoon, everybody. I think we're ready to start with today's call. My name is Nancy Anderson. I am a senior advisor for clinical laboratories in CDC's Division of Laboratory Systems. Today, I am temporarily taking over for Jasmine Chaitrams, who you are used to hearing in this role. She's taking a very well-deserved break, so I will be standing in for her just for today. On the screen, you'll see the agenda for today's call. We have several topics that are going to be presented as part of the call. And before I start with the agenda, I'm going to cover just a few announcements and some housekeeping items that I know many of you are used to hearing at the start of these calls. As you may have heard before, or you may know from previous work, we are the CDC division that works to advance laboratory quality and safety, data and biorepository science, and workforce competency across the U.S. clinical laboratory community. We also work closely both with clinical and public health laboratories across the country to support laboratory emergency preparedness and response activities. Throughout the COVID-19 response, for more than a year now, we've been supporting CDC's Emergency Operations Center by serving as the interface between CDC and the clinical and public health laboratory communities. Some of the tasks, as you've heard about on these previous calls, include laboratory biosafety, the regulatory requirements under the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendments, or CLIA, additional lab quality issues, and the challenges that are associated with implementing laboratory-developed tests. So these calls are an opportunity for the government agencies to provide you with valuable information for the testing that you're doing. We discuss hot topics, and we also solicit the questions from the community about the work that clinical labs are doing in support of the nation's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Because we do anticipate and already have a large number of participants on this call, and we get many questions, we may not be able to directly and immediately answer every issue. However, we do keep note of your questions and feedback, and they're very useful for helping us tailor the content of our future calls. So moving on to the housekeeping and reminders page, this talks about a recently published new resource for lab professionals, the Biological Risk Assessment, General Considerations for Laboratories webpage, which was just recently launched. From this page, you can get basic contents, you can see the steps for conducting a risk assessment, and also access a number of relevant resources. So please take advantage, take a look at this page, and share it broadly with your colleagues who may find it useful. Another page that CDC has recently updated is the Overview of Testing for SARS-CoV-2 webpage. There's new information here, so again, please share this information. And yet another page, CDC has now published a new webpage called Nucleic Acid Amplification Tests, or NATs. And here you can find information on the different type of NATs that are used to detect SARS-CoV-2. Also, as a reminder, CMS recently published a revised FAQ on March 19th that explained how they are temporarily exercising enforcement discretion under CLIA to say that labs or facilities can report variant results to public health departments for public health purposes without being CLIA certified or without conducting that testing in a CLIA certified setting. However, as always, if the results are reported for the purpose of diagnosis, prevention, or treatment of disease of of an individual, then the facility does need to be CLIA certified and follow the requirements for the testing. I also want to give you a little heads up and notification that next week, the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Advisory Committee, which CDC manages on behalf of HHS, will be meeting, and a virtual meeting will be available to the public at the website that you see here. One reason that I especially bring this to your attention now is because CLIAC, both at the last meeting in October of 2020, as well as this upcoming meeting, the overall theme of the meeting will be clinical laboratory medicine in the age of COVID-19. So the topics will be relevant to this response, and invite you to join in. The CLIAC website is available on the slide, and the meeting will be on the 14th and 15th from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. on both days. If you would like to submit a public comment or to present a comment orally during the meeting, you can contact the email address given here. One more slide. We'll be sharing slides today. During the call, the speakers will have slides, and we'll post them online along with the audio and transcript by sometime early next week. So you can find all of this information on the DLS preparedness portal at the website listed here. This is also where we'll post the slides, audio, and transcript from our previous calls. So you can go back in time and find any of them there. Just a reminder that we hold these calls every 2 weeks, and they last for 1 hour. So the next call after today will be on Monday, April 19th from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And one more reminder that our training and workforce development branch is always interested to learn more about the education and training gaps that you're experiencing or training that you need. So we invite you to send your email for this, your feedback via email at labtrainingneeds@cdc.gov. How to ask a question. So if you have a clinical laboratory related question you'd like our team to address on a future clinical laboratory COVID-19 response call, you can use the question and answer function, Q&A function, in Zoom during the call, or send an email to dlsinquiries@cdc.gov. If you submit a question using the Q&A function in Zoom or email, please include your email address so that we can get back to you. If you are a member of the media and have questions, please contact CDC Media Relations at media@cdc.gov. And if you are a patient, please direct any questions to your healthcare provider. I'd like to remind everybody that the presentation, the slide decks for the presentations today may contain presentation materials from panelists who are not affiliated with CDC. So the presentation content from the external panelists may not necessarily reflect CDC's official position. Please keep that in mind when you go back and look at the slides that we post on our preparedness portal. And at this time, I'm going to welcome our first speaker, Dr. Richard Krieger, who is with the NIH RADx Variant Task Force. So Richard, I think you can jump in and take it away.
All right, just doing a quick sound check. You can hear me okay, Nancy?
Yes, can still hear you clearly. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. So good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to quickly preview the the work that the Radix team has been doing with respect to the SARS-CoV-2 variants specifically and their impact on IVD testing on the programs that are being funded by NIH under Radix. Could I have the next slide, please? First and foremost, I want to let everyone know that there's a very large group of people working on this program for Radix. You can see the names of those that are associated with Radix on the left. We're partnered with Emory University, who are performing a lot of the lab work for us and also providing some guidance to us on some of our bioinformatics pipeline. We're working with some outside universities, such as University of Washington. And I would be remiss in not stating that we are working also closely with many other federal agencies, those listed below in that line, including the CDC, Department of Defense, Department of Energy, FDA, and other departments within NIH. And it's been a great effort. We wouldn't be as far along as we are if it weren't for everybody's help here. Next slide, please. So this program actually started on January 5th, right after the holiday break. I think at that time, everyone was starting to realize that the SARS-CoV-2 virus was mutating very quickly. And because the Radix effort is really focused on developing tests for the direct detection of the virus, either by nucleic acid amplification technologies or through antigen tests, we were concerned that these mutations could have an impact on the tests that were being developed. A number of these tests are already on the market, and other ones are working their way through development and clinical studies and EUA submissions, and we hope they'll be on the market soon. So our goal really was to come up with a method or methods by which we could quickly assess whether those products that are either on the market or being developed would be responsive, would still be able to detect all of the variants that were starting to emerge. And as I mentioned earlier, we are working closely with other federal agencies to put this program together. Next slide, please. I'm going to go quickly. Again, I think everybody on this call understands that whether there be changes in nucleotides or which might be nonsense mutations, so not a change in amino acids, or those changes in the nucleotide sequence, which would result in a amino acid change, whether that be a missense mutation or a deletion or an insertion, could have significant impact on any of the tests that are out there. And again, this slide just simply summarizes that those changes could end up leading to a loss in binding, that's binding of a ligand, such as an antibody, or lead to errors in binding of a primer or a probe. And both of those conditions would ultimately lead to a potential false negative in those tests, whether that be nucleic acid amplification or an antigen test. Also, those same changes, depending on where they are in the sequence, could actually reduce the overall binding. So it could actually reduce the affinity of an antibody for an epitope, or it could actually decrease the efficiency of an amplification reaction. And both of those cases could lead to a loss in sensitivity, or as an example, limit detection of those assays. So that's what we were worried about in at a high level. And that's the program that we put together over the last 3 months. And we've concluded from that whereas modeling would be great, and modeling is pretty well established in the molecular area, it's not that well established in the antigen area and the protein at the protein level. We wanted to develop a program which combined both modeling studies as well as clinical in vitro lab testing to actually determine whether a specific test would be able to detect a SARS-CoV-2 variant. Next slide, please. I'm going to go through the next slides pretty quickly. This is actually from the CDC site as of last week. It might be a change. I haven't looked today. But again, we're all well aware of the variants that are happening worldwide and here in the United States. And this is a reflection of what the CDC published last week of the most common variants, the common lineages that are circulating here in the United States. Next slide. This is a similar cut. This is from the nextstrain.org data website, where we've now mapped the evolution of the virus from December of 2019, and this is through the end of February of this year. And you can see in this graph, this is an excellent website for those that want to go there and play with the website. You can do a lot of analysis on this website and to actually track all the various variants that are circulating around the world. And this particular cut is from North America. And I think everyone on this call knows that variants are not homogeneous. Variants are really families of related mutations. A lot of the nomenclature that we're using here, which is the Pango nomenclature, are basing the names of these mutations specifically on changes in the spike protein. And as you can see on the next slide, this is also from the Nextstrain website. We are seeing mutations both at the nucleotide level and the amino acid level in every part of the genome of the virus. So it's not just the spike gene that's changed. Every gene indeed is showing a significant number of mutations. And this is what has us, Thor was concerned that these changes could impact the nucleic acid and the amino acid and the protein-based test. A lot of the protein-based tests are targeting two proteins, the spike protein and the nucleic acid protein. And you can see in the upper panel that there are significant changes in these variants in both of those proteins. And on the nucleotide level, or for the nucleic acid amplification test, a lot of the assays on the market and the assays under developing are targeting multiple genes. ORF1A and ORF1B are common targets, as is the nucleocapsid gene and the envelope gene. But indeed, you can see from here that every gene is indeed impacted. So next slide. So what we did is, this is a summary of the comprehensive program that we put together. It combines both a bioinformatic platform, which is known as Roslyn, and that's being provided by a commercial third-party vendor. And we're also tying that to actual clinical in vitro or wet lab testing. What Roslyn is able to do in the in the upper right, where it says sequence databases, Roslyn is pulling in sequence databases from GISID or GISAID, also from NCBI Gene Bank, and it also has the capability of pulling in sequences from other sequence providers, and such as what we are now working with NCBI on their curated database that is coming from the CDC surveillance program as well. So we're actually using this database to actually do bioinformatic modeling, both on the amino acid level and the nucleic acid level, with the various tests. Each of the companies that are participating, RADx, can enter their target epitopes if they know them, or they can enter in their primers and their probe sequences, regardless of what type of technology they're using, whether that be PCR, LAMP, FISH, or CRISPR. And the Roslyn system will use various bioinformatic modeling to identify what sequences may potentially cause an impact to their assay. On the amino acid level, on the protein level, we are doing some modeling that we put together with the help of some scientists at Emory. Those models are not as well developed as the nucleic acid technologies, so they might be more prone to errors. We're also using the Roslyn database, and we're also tracking very closely to what the CDC is pulling out. And we're working to actually acquire samples from the labs participating in both the CDC surveillance as well as other reference labs from around the U.S. to acquire clinical samples and to create a variants biobank. So again, Roslyn's helping us to identify variants of concern and variants of interest. And then we're reaching out to those labs that are participating in that surveillance program. And we're actually acquiring those actual clinical samples to create that biobank. We're now using that biobank, the testing has actually started today, to actually do in vitro clinical testing or wet lab testing at Emory. We're also going to send these panels to some of the companies that cannot send their products to Emory, so the manufacturers themselves. And we also are contracting an independent third-party site to do testing of diagnostic products. All those results, all these panels are being set up in a blinded fashion. So the manufacturers do not know what they're going to be testing. Each of the specimens are being prepared in a series of dilutions to go from relatively low CT to relatively high CT. So we can determine whether the test either can detect the virus or not, or perhaps if it's not a true LOD method that we're setting up, it's a LOD suggestive method, or almost like a range finding method, where we can see whether there's a difference in sensitivity as compared to the Wuhan strain that started this out, or the Washington strain, and that's the two most common strains that most of these tests were used for their development. So this is a comprehensive program that's actually up and running right now. Roslyn is live and the wet testing is live as of today. Next slide, please. And again, as I mentioned, we're working extremely closely with the CDC and the CDC surveillance program. We are contracting with many of the laboratories that are participating in this surveillance program for the acquisition of these clinical samples. Next slide, please. So where are we at so far today? Our bioinformatics program on Roslyn is up and running. That program is open to other federal agencies. The FDA is using that as we speak, as are other parts of NIH. And we have opened that up to other government agencies. And of course, it's also being used for ourselves to identify variants. And it's being used by the Radix companies to participate in their own analysis for the tests that they have as part of Radix. They also can actually use that for other tests that they're developing independent of Radix. We are then, as I mentioned, sourcing samples from the CDC-funded sequence laboratories and other laboratories. Right now, as of today, we have over 800 samples. CDC has recently mentioned Emory, and we soon will be sending out panels to all the other companies that cannot send their products to Emory for their own testing. Next slide, please. This is just, I'm not going to go through this. This is a complicated slide. This is a summary of the bioinformatics output that's coming out of Roslyn. We're an individual company, or Radix, because we can actually see all of the data as well. In the upper left here, you can add your manufacturing. Right now, we're focusing on the United States data, although eventually we'll be bringing in worldwide data. This database is currently updated weekly from GizAid and GeneBank, but it will soon be updating on a daily basis. And then on the lower right, you can each company could look at their individual genes, their individual primers and probes, and see what variants they might have an issue with. And those are known as incidents that are reported around the world. So again, it's a lot more complicated, complete than this particular slide. But the Roslyn platform offers a wide range of capabilities for the companies to determine if their products are actually potentially having an issue with variants, or to help them actually design new products that will actually have minimized their impact by variants. And then my last slide just summarizes what we're doing. So the virus is continuing to mutate. We're going to be using this program. It's not a one and done program. We're actually using this to identify new variants and to collect those variants and to continue to do wet testing for as long as the pandemic is continuing. And as I mentioned earlier, we're going to work closely with the CDC and other federal agencies to actually collect real-time field data. And with that, I'll bring it to an end. And maybe we'll take questions later, I think, at the end of this, or direct your question to the CDC, and I'll try and get back to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Richard. I'm scrolling through the questions that we have now, and I don't see any that I think are specifically for you. So if people have questions, please put them into the Q&A box and we will direct them to you or we will use them for a future call. But thank you so much for being with us today. And with that, we will move on to our next speaker, which is Dr. Ann Wiley, who is going to be talking with us about saliva as a sample type for SARS-CoV-2 detection. Thank you, Anne, for joining us, and we will let you, you can keep me posted, and I will take care of the slides for you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me. So, indeed, I'd like to share some of the work that we've been doing for our small research team has been doing on validating and optimizing saliva as a sample type for SARS-CoV-2 detection over the past year. Next slide, please. So very early on in the pandemic, like many others, we had all of the same difficulties with nasopharyngeal swabs, many of which we still see today. They are difficult to obtain. They do require trained healthcare professionals. We do get testing aversion in response to the prospect of nasopharyngeal swab. And of course, they carry risk to the healthcare workers if they are to, if the patients are to sneeze or cough in response onto that healthcare worker. Next. So while we were collecting these swabs very early on, we also just so happened to be collecting saliva. And as these samples were coming in, we were testing them all, both the swabs and saliva, for SARS-CoV-2 RNA. And we saw very early on that we were getting promising results. We saw comparable, if not better sometimes, detection of SARS-CoV-2 RNA in the saliva. So this is the paper that we published quite early last year and is in NEJM, showing that success that we had with saliva next. And so based on this, we continued with our research into validating saliva as a sample to help overcome some of the challenges that we were seeing with the swabs. Next slide, please. Next. So first and foremost, saliva tests must be designed for saliva. Saliva is the collection of all oral fluid. It is not sputum and it is not mucus. People, we try to discourage any sniffing or coughing prior to the sample collection. That also decreases the risk of respiratory droplets. But if not properly collected, saliva can be difficult to work with. Next. Since saliva is not a traditional diagnostic sample type, methods for swabs don't necessarily work on saliva. We did look at 54 RT-qPCR-based studies comparing saliva and swabs, and we actually saw that in 69% of those samples in those studies, saliva had greater or similar sensitivity to swabs. Saliva also detected an additional 10% of positive cases. Next. So this sort of suggests that maybe some discrepancies that we see in these comparison studies are actually due to poor samples or poor methods. Next slide, please. So good quality saliva samples can be collected. We've really refined our protocol, having people be patient, think about their favorite food, don't sniff or cough, and don't spit, with the idea that that spit can create a lot of aerosols as well. Next. So we had 30 study participants. They had four devices each, a funnel, a bulb transfer pipette, pipette tip, short straw, and we observed them in an unobserved collection. So all cameras switched off, microphones switched off. They had instructions. They hadn't been given any verbal instructions, and they had to collect saliva for us. Next. And based on this, we saw, so on the left, we had the participant feedback. We asked a whole array of participant feedback, but overall, we found that participants felt as though they didn't need help while collecting their saliva, and they felt pretty confident that they had collected their sample properly. In the lab, when these samples were received, they were all pretty much of sufficient volume, they were easy to pipette, they were true saliva, free from food particles, and they were not discolored. And importantly, they were all mostly in the expected range that we'd have for human RNase-P as our sample quality control. Next. So with this in mind and thinking about mass testing strategies, we developed Saliva Direct, which is an extraction-free and dual-plex RT-qPCR. Next. We developed that in mind with the for access to testing to make it less invasive, less expensive, less prone to supply chain issues, to really help improve access and especially thinking about mass testing strategies going forward. Next. This was developed on our principles that we found saliva is stable without preservatives. Next. So this means that no expensive collection devices are required. You can take a raw saliva in a simple laboratory plastic tube. And we tested these samples fresh or after 7 days at 4 degrees Celsius, room temperature for 7 days, 30 degrees Celsius for 7 days, 40 degrees Celsius for 72 hours. And we also put them through the FDA summer and winter profiles. And we found, you know, you see a little bit of fluctuation in the CT values there, but ultimately these raw saliva samples are stable without expensive preservatives, allowing simple laboratory plastic tubes to be used, which can keep the cost prices down when doing mass testing strategies. Next. We were also very keen on keeping as much sensitivity as possible while taking out that RNA extraction. So, you know, we started developing this a year ago when, you know, obviously RNA extraction, PCR is still the gold standard, most sensitive approach. We were terrified of false negatives. So we made sure that when developing this assay, we kept that level of sensitivity. The Saliva Direct has the registered sensitivity as the same as the CDC's RNA extraction PCR assay, so we were very pleased with that. Next. We were also keen to keep the sensitivity when dual-plexing the PCR. We had been doing N1, N2, and RP, all from the CDC, in single-plex, but getting them into that dual-plex was just important for time and also for saving on resources. And again, we maintained that level of sensitivity. Next. Importantly, we validated multiple vendors, reagents, PCR instruments at every single step of the way. This is just the subset from our initial validation, but we did this to make sure that labs could use their existing supply chains. They could use whatever they had, you know, some of the better relationships that they have with their existing suppliers, especially the PCR instrumentation. We didn't want labs to be having to buy anything new. And importantly, we also wanted to keep competition between the suppliers so that we wouldn't see price hikes in response to any of our methodology. Next. What's been really interesting to see in this is that we developed a universal RT-qPCR protocol. So we have master mixes from NEB, Bio-Rad, Thermo Fisher, we've got the new QuantaBio one. And regardless of the master mix that we have, regardless of the instrumentation you have, we've found that we can have a universal PCR protocol across all of those instruments and mixes, again, just to keep things simple. So if one of your PCR mixes run out, you can just still use this same PCR protocol without having to worry about updating and make it, you know, reagent specific. Next. One of our most recent developments that we've had, which is also very exciting, is that we actually took that standard universal protocol, the same sort of master mixes that we were using, and expanded that for the 384 well format as well. So we have now validated this assay in 96 well format instruments and 384 well instruments. It's been a fabulous collaborative effort. I was unaware at first that it could potentially not be able to do 20 microliter reaction mixes in the 384 well format, but many labs jumped to help us out and validated this half mix that we can use to high throughput testing. Next. And this is some of our validation from the 384 well format work. So right on the left, you have the list of the different 384 well format PCR instruments, and then next to that are the different PCR kits. And these are the results from our LOD finding studies. And again, I mean, this is just the finding study, so we do only do the three replicates, but you can see that for most of these combinations, we are between that 1.5 and 6 copies per microliter, so roughly around the 3 copies per microliter with this universal protocol, with any sort of combination of these different reagents and instruments. Next. We've also continued to evolve our protocol. So this has been in response to a number of the labs that we've worked with who have been wanting to do heat pre-treatment after they, well, when receiving their samples in labs, they prefer to heat them. So we saw what was commonly being used or asked for. We evaluated 95 degrees for 5 minutes, 95 degrees for 30 minutes, and 65 degrees for 15 minutes. And we trialed this with the standard saliva direct protocol, but also going straight into PCR as well. So we've heard that this can make the samples safer to handle, but we've also heard that this can improve the viscosity of the saliva for easier pipetting. Next. And these are also our LOD finding results from this. So this is actually going down to those 20 replicates in the different combinations. And again, we were hitting around that 3 to 6 copies per microliter with these different steps, with and without the normal saliva direct protocol. Next slide, please. We have also validated how this works in asymptomatic individuals for large screen in scale screening. This is just a validation study, and we only fortunately this was done with a group that were doing very, very well with their bubble, so we had very few positive samples come back, but we were collecting saliva to test by saliva direct, and that was being compared to a paired anterior naris and oropharyngeal swab tested by Questel BioReference. So we did have a high positive agreement, but ultimately we've tested almost 4,000 paired samples. We saw a very, very low invalid rate being negative for RP and an incredibly low false positive rate with this. Next slide, please. We've also looked at the CT values that we got from symptomatic and asymptomatic individuals. And when you plot them side by side, we actually find that whether someone's symptomatic or asymptomatic, those mean CT values do not really differ. So just because you're asymptomatic doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have a low viral load. Next slide, please. So that was a lot to rush through, I really know, but I really thank you for your time. And just wanted to leave just a full disclaimer disclosure. We make no profit from Saliva Direct, no licensee fees, no commissions, no royalties. We simply are able to authorize CLIA certified labs to use this protocol. But really the main thing behind Saliva Direct that we did was to help reduce testing costs for the community, to help reduce the implementation time that labs need to use saliva. We continue to do that validation work for you, but importantly, to increase the number of tests available in the community and to increase the number of affordable tests in the community. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much, Dr. Wiley. We do have several questions here, and I think we have some time. First, I'll ask, there were a couple of questions that I think were specific to your study. Can you go back up? There we go. The first ones were, what volume of saliva do you need, and how long are the samples stable for use in PCR?
So we only use 50 microliters for this assay. We do generally ask that, you know, people give 200 to 500 microliters just so that, you know, you can exclude bubbles just in case you need to revisit the sample for any reason, but you do just need 50 microliters. We always freeze our sort of lysates. So the samples remain stable. As we show, the raw saliva itself can remain stable at a variety of conditions, for at least 7 days. And then once we do the sort of the workup, we get that lysate. We generally try to test that as soon as possible, but we do actually freeze ours at minus 80, and it can survive a number of freeze thaws with robust N1 detection as well.
Okay. And one more minor question, does pH variation cause difficulty?
So we don't see that in The only thing that we've found to inhibit, so when you get RP negative, you've seen, you know, something is inhibiting the reaction so far, the thing that we've identified so far are blood and mucus. And that's when you particularly have maybe a severely ill inpatient. But again, this is why we very much stress that you need just that good normal saliva. Take a swallow, let the normal saliva flow back into the mouth. That is what you want to test. That's what's easier to pipette. And with that, you know, we've had saliva of every single color come through from various foods and drinks that people have eaten, but we still always get that RP detection. So far we've only identified blood and mucus as inhibitory.
Okay, great. Now here's another one that's a little bit related to that. I understand the need to not have actual sputum in the sample, but can you comment on the sensitivity discrepancy between saliva without coughing and saliva with coughing in the IDSA grade summary?
I think that really depends on the stage of infection that one person is at. So, you know, has that got down into the lungs? Do you want to bring that up? Can you potentially collect more signal that way? If that's a, you know, severely or an ill patient, I think early on in an infection, you probably wouldn't see that so much. So the study that I touched on where we compared all the different PCR studies, that's actually in press at the moment. So that table, we have a table comparing all of this coming out soon. There are actually other studies that also use coughing or not. And there's also a lot of discrepancy between coughing. So I don't really necessarily think it's even always just the coughing, but in the end, the method that is used to extract the RNA, even if extractionless, but you know, just the fact that you need still a robust, whatever sample you collect, however you collect it, it needs to be the right method for obtaining the right amount of that RNA for detection. And that's what's more important.
Great, thank you. Now I think I'll ask you a couple that are related to antigen testing. There was one, a general question, can you use saliva for antigen testing? And then there's one more here that says, going forward, do you see the standard saliva direct protocol being used as a comparator for those who are developing saliva-based antigen assays instead of having them go up against NP as the comparator?
So that is actually a great question for the FDA, and this is a question that we struggle with ourselves at times and how we can do that. I mean, to some extent, I mean, there are a number of EUA saliva tests out there at the moment. And indeed, I mean, if these tests have EUA, you know, they're getting robust detection with saliva, I think personally, sorry, my own personal opinion, that it could be fair to have this as a comparator, but of course that guidance does obviously have to come down as from above. And of course, getting the nasopharyngeal swabs can be difficult. There is also the risk with nasopharyngeal samples that you can detect historic cases. So you can have that prolonged shedding of RNA from a nasopharyngeal sample. So you're not even testing an active infection, which can make that an unfair comparison to make when you're trying to capture an active infection, if that also makes sense. So that is something that I think, you know, is a very interesting topic for further conversation.
Good, good. Well, we'll use that to transition to the FDA, but let me just squeeze in one more quick one. Did you include pediatric specimens in your saliva direct study?
We haven't, in this data, we do not have pediatrics, but I work closely with, we're doing some childcare studies at the moment. So we are actually collecting saliva samples from infants. You know, we're using transfer bulk pipettes to sort of try and get saliva out of their mouth. We have 2 and 3 year olds who are, well, more than 3 year olds are very capable of providing a raw saliva sample. So we are testing infant populations as part of studies. I'm not sure how, if that will be, you know, taken into the our EUA anytime soon, but it is possible.
Okay, well, thank you so much. As you can see, there's a lot of questions about this and a lot of interest. We will turn it over at this point to the FDA, but if you have time and want to scroll through and see any other questions that you can answer, feel free to do that in the Q&A box. But we really appreciate the presentation and the information that you shared with us.
I'd be happy to take those questions. And thank you again for having me.
Thank you. And so at this time, we are going to turn it over. Tim Stenzel, who is generally with us every call to answer the FDA-related questions, is not available today. So we have Sarah Brenner stepping in to take his place. And we will let Sarah, I'll move on to the FDA slides, and we will let Sarah proceed with answering the questions or presenting any updates she would like to. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much, Nancy. Just double-checking you can hear me because I did change my audio.
Yes, you sound just fine.
Perfect. Tim sends his regards, and I'm the Chief Medical Officer for In Vitro Diagnostics at FDA, and I've been detailed also to HHS on the national response as a diagnostics data lead for a year now. Crazy. So I'm just going to run through questions that came in from last week and provide some office-cleared answers. I anticipate there will be a lot of questions, potentially coming in today about some of the newer releases from FDA, including the serial screening pathway and so on and so forth. I'll do the best I can, but of course can take any questions back to the office to present next Monday. So what came in last week, I'll just run them through. Now that the BioFire Respiratory Panel 2.1 has gone through the de novo pathway, well, all new tests for SARS-CoV-2 have to go through the 510K process, or will a new EUA still be accepted? I think Tim addressed this in previous calls, but we are still receiving and reviewing EUA requests for SARS-CoV-2 tests. That will probably be the case for quite some time. Including multi-analyte tests that include SARS-CoV-2. So we don't see an end to doing that for as far out as we can see. Next, are commercial tests assessing neutralizing antibodies for COVID in the pipeline, and what can you share regarding protective titers of such antibodies? There is one authorized test to detect neutralizing antibodies, and we are interested in working with developers of additional neutralizing antibody tests. So if you're one of those, bring them in, and as always, we encourage you to engage early and often with FDA. How is FDA regulating reporting for OTC COVID-19 tests? For example, the Q Health point of care, which is now fully over-the-counter PCR test. So this is sort of a complex question, not entirely in the lane of FDA, but across the federal response, including HHS. FDA itself is not solely responsible for regulating the responsibility of reporting to public health authorities, but FDA does work with USG partners who do. So that would include other sister agencies and HHS all the way up to the department level, and there's high-level policy at the White House level that also dictates the secretary level and the White House level that dictates reporting requirements. So while FDA has not issued its own standalone sort of requirement as part of the authorization process for at-home tests, we do strongly encourage it, and we actively work with test developers who bring EUAs in on plans to implement reporting solutions. And when I get to the end of the questions, I'll drop a link in the chat or the Q&A to diagnostic data and reporting information on HHS's website, which includes frequently asked questions and also includes a table, mandatory minimum core data elements for all COVID-19 diagnostic tests, that's broken down by federal, state requirements, and also the source of the data for lab-based and non-lab-based tests. So over-the-counter tests would be, of course, non-lab-based tests. I will point out, since the example was asked specifically here about Q, that Q did go to market with a data capture, harmonization, and automation, and wireless transmission to public health authorities capability. So they're one of what I would consider a gold standard diagnostics company that that already integrated those capabilities into their diagnostic workflow at the launch of the product. Next question. Is there an EUA-approved dry home dry blood spot DBS collection kit? There is not a standalone DBS collection kit authorized for use with SARS-CoV-2 serology tests at this time. Next question, can you help us understand the difference between direct-to-consumer claims versus over-the-counter claims for an EUA at-home collection kit for SARS-CoV-2 testing at a reference lab? So OTC or over-the-counter indicates that no prescription is needed. You could walk up and purchase that test at will from a pharmacy or other vendor. We tend to refer to non-prescription home collection kits where the sample is sent to a lab for processing as direct-to-consumer to distinguish them from the over-the-counter at-home tests where there's no lab involvement, since the latter is what most people think of when they hear OTC. Last question, people have been using EUA-authorized PCR and antigen tests for screening throughout the last year without enforcement. Does FDA now intend to enforce EUAs for screening? So it's a little clarification on this question here. Screening claims have always been regulated by FDA. We have authorized screening claims when supporting data was submitted. For tests authorized for individuals suspected of COVID-19, healthcare providers should always prescribe them for screening at the healthcare provider's discretion. However, the test developer could not market them for screening without having that claim authorized. And this still remains the case. So the new supplemental template that I referenced at the beginning opens a new approach, a new pathway to get a serial screening claim so that you could market it as such. And we do have a post-authorization validation of asymptomatic serial screening requirement for that claim. And those were the questions that came in, and I'll turn it back over to you, Nancy, and thanks for showing some of our links. I'm also going to drop, as I mentioned, one in the chat having to do with diagnostic data elements, capture reporting at the federal and state levels. Based on whether the data is flowing from a lab-based diagnostic or a non-lab-based diagnostic.
Okay, thank you, Sarah. I am going to ask a question that is very similar to one that you already answered, and I do believe Tim has answered it before, but perhaps someone new is on the call and didn't hear the answer. It is a question about EUAs moving to full FDA approval like the BioFire test. And can you clarify whether this will be required or recommended for all EUAs at some point, or will the EUAs permanently remain in place?
So I'm not sure exactly how Tim answered that previously. I mean, typically EUAs stay in place until a public health emergency is rescinded at the secretary level, which of course is the department above FDA, so it's not a purely FDA decision. Whether or not, folks who are holding EUAs want to go ahead and apply for the full approval process, the full approval pathway, would be up to them. Certainly they might feel that it's in their best interest to do so, or others might not. So I don't think that FDA is going to really, issue a formal statement or encouragement, et cetera, with regards to what folks do. But I can go back and check. We could be surprised, but that would be my hunch.
Okay. Thank you. Let me see if there are any others for FDA here. Let's see. This one I'm not sure if you have an answer for. There are several sequencing instruments on the market. Variant sequencing is not yet approved for clinical use. Do you foresee variant sequencing will be approved for clinical use in 2021? And what are your thoughts about moving the testing into the clinical laboratory?
I'm not sure how to answer that one or what the agency's official stance on that is. Certainly we're open to changes and recommendations and movements to incorporate new technology, especially when the data suggests that clinical care could be advanced in that way. So I would say FDA would be open to that, but I'm not aware of a formal position or stance that the agency has at this time.
Okay. I'm not really seeing anything else that seems to be specific for FDA. So I think we will let you off the hook for today. Appreciate your stepping in for Tim. And let me take in one more scroll to the bottom. I don't think there is anything else there that is directly asking a question of FDA. So if we get something, you know, we will send it on to you and you can answer it on the next call. But we appreciate your being here today and we'll look forward to either you or Tim being back on the next call.
Great. Thanks so much, Nancy.
Thanks, Sarah. And with that, let me make sure I didn't miss. Oh, here was another FDA slide that some people may be interested and need this information. Here are some of the social media websites for information from CDC. So that is bringing us to the close of the call for today. Again, thank you all for being here, for listening. We hope the information that we have provided is helpful to you. We do encourage you, if you haven't already done so, to opt into the CDC Laboratory Outreach Communication System, or LOCS, to get ongoing lab communication that we put out related to the COVID-19 response. So if you need to sign up for that, please send us a message at locs@cdc.gov, or you can click the link for that in the chat box. As we mentioned before, we will be posting the slides, the transcript, and the audio to the website by early next week. So for any of these resources, please visit our preparedness portal. Another reminder that we hope you will be able to join us on our next call on Monday, April 19th at 3 p.m., we will have the CDC director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, who will be giving the opening remarks on that call. So we hope you'll be able to join us and encourage your clinical lab partners and colleagues to join us for that call. And once again, if today or at any time in the future you have questions to submit for consideration for this call or that you need an answer to, please use the Q&A function in the Zoom or email us at dlsinquiries@cdc.gov. And if you do submit a question, again, please make sure to include your email address so that we have a way to get back in touch with you. And I think that is it for today. Again, thank you again for joining us. Thank you for all of the good work that you continue to do. We are grateful for you and the important work you are doing in the COVID-19 pandemic response. And we look forward to talking with you again in another couple of weeks. So have a good afternoon, everybody.